sports has always lended the opportunity for diversity with regard to teams that win. I always ask people, when you're winning the Stanley Cup or the World Series, do you look and say, hey, there's my black teammate over there who's winning with me? No, he's your teammate. You know, when there's a brawl that breaks out, you know, do you say, all right, I'm going to go look for the white guy, or I'm going to go hit the black guy first? They don't do that kind of stuff. I mean, they're you know, it's a team function that we have to take into account. And I would only hope that their ability to have such a forum can lead into other things that can make this whole situation more effective and where we can get more out of this.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, and it's almost Flag Day, June 14th. And Flag Day means one thing around Busch Stadium. It is the Mike Claiborne-approved day to begin checking the standings. This Flag Day, they're blank. Indefinitely PPD. While twin crises have engulfed our country, baseball seems reduced to squabbles as the owners and players negotiate a return to play. Who better to talk to at this time than Mike Claiborne himself? Owner and host of Claibs Online, he's also been part of the sports media in St. Louis for four decades, and he's currently a Cardinals broadcaster on KMOX 1120 AM. We talk about empty standings, but full voices as athletes become activists, and baseball's big chance this Flag Day to stop playing games and stand up for something. First, let me tell you about our sponsor, Closets by Design. Imagine your home totally organized. Closets by Design specializes in custom closets, pantries, laundry rooms, garages, and more. Now get 40% off plus an additional 15% off. Closets by Design, 314-733-9855. That's Closets by Design, the official sponsor of the best podcast in baseball, 314-733-9855. Now, here's my conversation with Mike Claiborne of KMOX. It's my pleasure to have Claibs Online owner, Cardinals broadcaster Mike Claiborne on, especially at this time of year because, and probably many people know where I'm going with this, it's almost Flag Day. And for you, Mike, that is a key point in any baseball season. And yet in this baseball season, there won't be any games. So what do we do without standings on Flag Day?
Well, I think if we play, and I know we will, we'll have to kind of assess how many games we have and probably extend that date of maturity. For people who haven't heard about Flag Day, I don't know where you've been, first of all. Here's how I've been able to assess this being a key date on the baseball calendar. Because you've had enough games under your belt where you've had hot streaks, you've had cold streaks, you've had guys that have been injured, you had guys that have surprised you, you had people that are maybe, you know, starting to warm up a little bit, and you have a feel for what your ball club looks like. And from that point on, the games have greater consequence because you now know what needs as a general manager you have to address. You now know what needs as coaches and managers you need to be better at. And if you're an individual player, you know what you need to do more and less of, and you probably know what your role is going to be on the ball club for the remainder of the year. So for those guys who came out of spring training and they were trying to crack the rotation, well, maybe they didn't have anything after the fifth inning as far as pitching was concerned, so all of a sudden they're now in the bullpen. If you are a hitter and you got off to a hot start and all of a sudden you can't get it going, maybe you're platooning with someone else, or now all of a sudden you are a guy coming off the bench, or even worse, you might be in Memphis. So there's a lot of things that go on leading up to Flag Day, and I think you have a real compass of your team as far as its direction after that. And, you know, so far, so good. You know, when I've never done a scientific chart on who does what. But, you know, Derek, it's always one of those situations where you kind of know by Flag Day or how good you are.
Mike, there's a lot to talk about, starting with, you know, DeWitt's comments about teams not being as profitable as maybe fans think they are, to athletes finding their voices right now as activists. But I wanted to kind of start here with this Flag Day notion because it does hit at the urgency that owners and players have this week as they negotiate a return to the field and consider how small of a season is too small to count as a season. For you, where is that number? Is 48 too small? Is 82 the limit?
I think anything under 82, and I'm not sure if you can really validate it as a season, you know, as far as something we would appreciate. And granted, this season will have an asterisk next to it anyway, but I think from a credibility standpoint, you have to say to yourself, well, you know, did we really see enough to know if this was the best baseball team? And then I guess the answer would be, well, they're the best 50-game team we've ever seen, or the best 82-game team we've ever seen. And I think it really is going to be interesting to see if they come. I'm circling 82 as a game, a season. So for me, I'm intrigued by how organizations approach that. You know, I mean, as far as, you know, we normally would let a guy play himself into a situation or play himself out. And I look at the Cardinals, for instance. Going into spring training, we were all wondering, what about Matt Carpenter? What about Dexter Fowler? Because those are two guys they were counting on, two guys that really didn't live up to the expectations. Although Dex played well during the regular season, didn't do anything in postseason. But what happens if one of those guys falls out of the gate and falls on his face? How long can you go with him if you've got somebody else that you think can replace him? The DH is going to help. It gives you more versatility. But I think the key for the Cardinals will be their pitching from what we saw in spring training. And again, that's all I can preface it on, because I don't know what these guys look like now. I know some guys say they've been throwing and doing this, but this is unlike an offseason, because even in an offseason, you can work out and you can do some things. This situation is one where a lot of things were shut down. Now, there's some guys I'm sure that were throwing somewhere, but nothing in the environment that they're accustomed to when it comes to an offseason, being in the gym or being in the cage or being able to throw a little bit in a more controlled environment. We haven't experienced that, at least most of them haven't. So what they show up looking like is going to be interesting. The mindset of some players who may begrudgingly be there compared to getting what they want. And, you know, you've heard guys say, well, I'm taking a big risk. Well, anytime I've ever seen a guy play cautious, he always gets hurt. He never lives up to the expectation. And I know guys are running the risk of getting hurt. And I know Blake Snell saying, you know, I'm putting everything on the line. Well, I put my life on the line every time I walk out of the house. I mean, I think we've got to be more pragmatic here with regard to the situation. I say it's kind of a long answer to a short question, but I just think there's a lot to be still discovered in this process. And obviously it starts with how many games are we going to play? And let's face it, we're going to play. The owners still have the trump card here to force a season, but I don't know how exuberant the players will be if they are forced to go back and play.
One of the things they say about the baseball All-Star game that sets it apart from the other All-Star games is that it's hard to play baseball at half speed. It's actually one of the curiosities of working out in baseball, that you don't really work out at game speed. You can see velocity off a pitching machine, but it's not the same thing. And ground balls that are being hit, you know, for drills are, you know, they're being hit for drills. So it's hard to kind of work out at game speed, but it's also hard to dial that back. And you're right. Like, if they do, then what's that look like? You know, the other part that you touched on there is not only, you know, is this so different than the off season because of facilities, but there was no target date when players are working out in the off season. They know,
they're
going to report to spring training. They have a good idea when opening day is going to be, but here it was nebulous. They could take 4 weeks off and maybe still have 8 weeks to get ready.
You know, and you're spot on. And it's an interesting point you make, because, you know, I was talking to some players when this thing first started, and they were still continuing to work. And one guy who I said that I thought, if this thing comes back and we play a reasonable facsimile of a season, Tommy Pham could be the MVP because of his work ethic. And the fact that he continued to grind well after guys had put their bats and gloves down, because we figured this thing was going to be longer than anybody anticipated. But I said a guy like Tommy Pham is going to work no matter what, because A, this is all he knows. B, this is all he, this is the only thing he knows how to do is work hard. But at some point, he's got to scale it back. And some other guys have to scale it back. So I just think that we don't know what we're going to see when this thing gets going. And you know, Derek, it may be all the same. You know, maybe there's not a team that will break through, but there's a person that may break through. But I don't know if you'll see an entire team break through, because this is something they haven't had a chance to work at together. Now, some guys will, you know, get up and it's just like falling off a bike, and they'll figure it out sooner right. than others. But I think you're going to have some guys that are really going to have to find their way. And I don't know if all of them can do it at the same time.
It's interesting then too, because it becomes, and we've discussed this in like previous podcasts, is this notion of a team has to be ready for a sprint, not a marathon. And, you know, back to the flag day importance, is it does offer sort of a milepost for where, say, a hill arrives, mm-hmm. right? And you know what kind of team you have, or what kind of strength you have to get up that hill as summer arrives, the dog days arrives, the trade deadline. Let's say it's a water stop, I guess, along the marathon, arrives, and you can kind of replenish yourself or replenish your roster. If it's a 50 game thing, you know, or even like an 82 game thing, maybe there is no flag day. Maybe it's just a sprint.
Oh, I think you're right. No, I think that we are in sprint mode. You know, you're looking for the Usain Bolts right now. You may not even have a window to make a deal. You may, and this is where organization comes into play. This is why I think the Cardinals have a little bit more of an advantage, because they have a few more big league ready players than maybe some other teams. Because I don't know, unless there's a team that's looking to do a salary dump, well, they already know, you know, we're not going anywhere. We weren't going anywhere before this. But in this situation, you know, do we rely on a Dylan Carlson's and maybe a Nolan Gorman gets a whiff or somebody like that compared to trying to make a deal? But because those bad teams are saying, look, we want to clear the books for 2021 because we don't know what 2022 is going to look like. So maybe we just quietly move a player or two if there's going to be a window like that. I don't know if Major League Baseball is going to say, hey, look, you play with the hand you've been dealt. And we'll worry about 2021 next year in the offseason and free agency and all of that.
Well, I think there are some teams that like see. Okay, so the free agent market, it's going to change. It's going to shrivel, right? The spending will be limited. But the arbitration market won't. So like a guy like Jack Flaherty, even though he may have, you know, a severely shortened season or a cut in half season this year, he still has last year as a platform year to kind of lean on when it comes to arbitration. And arbitration is going to assure raises. That's how that process works. It's actually been one of the areas where players have been able to get the biggest bump, even though it's still controlled by service time. So I'm interested to see what some teams, like you have the Cubs in Cleveland, and they have superstar players who are going into their final year of arbitration, which is obviously the richest year. And with revenues down, do they try to bail? You know, I've also heard executives discuss that there might be some of those kind of kind of tender moves, mm-hmm. right? The guys who are going to non-tender, you might move off your roster or try to trade ahead of time. And, you know, because you're not going to tender them, and those decisions might be more constrained financially. Like, I guess an example of that would be like John Gant, right? Last year was his first year in arbitration. This year he's coming up and for a second time. Does that double his salary? And does that mean that the Cardinals kind of, you know, do a move to avoid non-tendering him, which they would choose to do?
Well, you know, that's a great question. But I think here's what's even more challenging: finding a dance partner to get some sort of quality return as far as talent is concerned. Because, you know, if you listen to the owners, none of them they barely have two nickels to rub together. So in this situation, you know, they want to make a deal to dump a salary. And then, you know, how can you take it on? And how are you going to take the risk of going into arbitration or free agency with this player that somebody else who may be better suited financially than you? How are you going to be able to do it if this other guy wasn't willing to do it? I just think there's some dice rolling that's going on here, but I also think, Derek, that there's got to be some guys that are quietly working behind the scenes, as you kind of indicated, to say, if this happens, then this is what we like to do. You know, if anybody thinks everybody's sitting at home waiting on midnight to strike when free agency can start or tenders can start, you're sadly mistaken. I don't think anybody wants to get caught short without a chair if the music stops.
What has been your view as these discussions have played out rather publicly, this back and forth, the exchange of rhetoric, the exchange of counterpunches, the exchange of counterproposals, the exchanges of, you know, veiled accusations, the exchanges of not so veiled frustrations?
It's to be expected for baseball. If you look at the other sports and you circle the NBA, they've had pretty much labor peace over the years. They've always been able to get out in front. I'll go one step further. The NHL, the National Hockey League, they have Donald Fehr representing the players. And we all know Donald Fehr from his days in baseball. Donald Fehr has been a much more approachable, reasonable person with regard to negotiations for the National Hockey League, to the point where they elected not to have trigger the reopener for negotiations for the CBA. And they currently, even during this pandemic, have already started to talk with the NHL about extending their CBA. No, nothing's been said. No big media blitz or anything like that. They're quietly doing it. But I just think the tradition between players and owners in baseball is unlike the other sports. The NFL, the owners there just run over the players. They run over them like Marines at Iwo Jima, man. I mean, it's not even fair in how those players have been dealt with. But I look at the NBA and I look at the NHL, and they have a better, more realistic and objective relationship with the other side, and more of a partnership compared to what we see with baseball.
Why do you think that is, Mike? You have experience in other sports.
I think it's the history of the two sides going back to when the union was first formed by Marvin Miller. And Marvin Miller had kind of conditioned the players to say, the owners are not your friends. And there have been owners that have done some things that would be considered high-handed or maybe not what you would call a fair approach in dealing with employees, that has created this distrust over time. And when you look back and you go back to 94 and they just shut it down and they were just willing to walk away from it. While the game may have gotten healthier, I don't think the relationship did. So but I think when you exit Gene Orza and Donald Fehr, you enter Rob Manfred and some other people, Michael Winter, who's no longer with us, that created a little bit more goodwill along the way. So then you lose Wehner. Here comes Tony Clark. Now, Tony Clark was a former player, a very sharp and intelligent guy who kind of gets it. And so now we're seeing he and Rob Manfred kind of talk. Well, Manfred had been at this table before. You know, Clark wanted to go out and surround himself with some people who had some negotiating experience along with Clark's ability to apply common and realistic sense. And you kind of thought it was going to move in that direction. I think where we hit a bump in the road where we had some owners who maybe weren't as cash rich as they needed to be to own a baseball team, that kind of pushed the panic button about what they couldn't afford. And therefore, they were willing to, it was all or nothing for them compared to some other owners who'd been around a little bit, knew how to invest their money, knew how to sit on some in the event, and they were a little bit more patient. The problem is the veteran owners have probably just said, you know, we have too many guys that don't know how to manage their own mess, so we've been sucked into this. And therefore, the players feel like it's all of them feeling this way compared to just a few. But I think the relationship has become slightly toxic, not to the point where it's name calling or anything like that. Because, Derek, when this is over with, they're all going to have to work together in some way, shape, or form. But I think that the distrust goes back to when the union was first created and the fact that they wanted things that owners look at and say, how dare you? I think if the baseball union took on the NFL owners, boy, you'd have a real fist fight going on because, as I mentioned earlier, the NFL Players Association is weak on its best day.
That is a nice way to kind of lead into the comments that Bill DeWitt Jr. made during a radio interview with Frank Cusimano here in St. Louis this past week. And they echoed some comments that he's made before. I had a long talk with him in his office a year ago, towards the end of the year, just asking him about like Ballpark Village and the revenue and when, you know, the spoils of that might spill onto the ball field and, you know, show up in the roster. And he said that that is for somebody else to calculate because it won't be for on his watch, which I thought was interesting. To Cusimano, he brought up that word that you did too, the distrust. And he said that there's clear distrust between the owners and the players because the players don't believe the owners when they say that profits are shrinking or that profits aren't as large as maybe the perception is. And that revenues have been turned off almost completely this year. How do you, if you have one side going to Twitter, both sides leaking to media, and an owner suggesting publicly that profits aren't what players think they are shortly after he buys a multi-million dollar home in LA very publicly, can you mend this fence?
I think instead of using Gorilla Glue, you're probably going to have to do an extra wrapping of duct tape.
Okay.
You know, in order to try and get this thing solidified. Now, you know, I understand what Bill DeWitt's saying. And I'm not saying that because I work for the Cardinals. I think Bill DeWitt has gone through this enough. He understands business. And there is a price to do business, okay? And that's something I think we have to take into account. I think where the players, where they're raising their hand in distrust, you know, I think that they see there's going to be a new revenue stream. And I think this is what Bill DeWitt's talking about. It's not as easy to make money anymore because we've maxed out the TV deals locally. We have our luxury boxes. We have our ballpark villages. So where is the next revenue stream going to come from? And I think that's what concerns the players, where they do a deal and all of a sudden, maybe it's gambling. Maybe it's something that we don't have a great vision in as you and I speak, but the owners have found something that they can sit on and say, hey, you know what? This can bring in an extra $100 million a year to each team or something along that line. And I think the players don't want to get caught short. I think that has a lot to do with it. And I think the gaming element is something that while nobody's talking about other than the NBA basically said, if you guys want to bet on us, it's going to cost you. I think the owners may have been able to do that, add water to it, and maybe there's another revenue stream that we just don't see or haven't thought about. And I don't think the players want to be on the outside looking in on that like we've seen in the past.
Absolutely. Well, that's like the crux of any conversation is how owners define revenue and how willing they are to open up their books so that the players can counter by how they want to define revenue. I mean, they see Major League Baseball advanced media, right? And see all the jackpot that has been for owners. Well, where is that in revenue? There's a lot of different ways to, like you said, I mean, if the owners negotiate with an 8-slice pie with the players and know that they're going to have a 12-slice pie on the side, that's what players want to know about. And it's an interesting spot because there does have to be a leap of faith on the players' part unless the owners just out and out open their books, which we saw somewhat, you and I, many, many years ago with the NHL as it approached losing an entire season to a lockout. There were teams that were like, here, look at our books. The Blues were one of them. Said, here we are. Let's talk because we need to figure out a better way, salary cap, a split of revenue. But in baseball, I get the sense neither side really wants that. Owners talk about it. Players don't want it. Tony Clark came right out and said, we don't even take something that looks like a salary cap. But in the end, I don't really think the owners want that either, because some of them just want to, splurge when they have a great talent and try to make a run at a title, right?
Yeah.
I mean, or I mean, I just don't think that, like you talked about, like the culture of baseball contributing to the acrimony between players and owners because of history. I also get the same sense that that would be the same aversion to a salary cap. You know, this notion that owners want a salary cap. I don't know, man. I think that's a departure for them.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think the Anaheim Angels, the LA Angels, would be able to afford Mike Trout and their third baseman and Albert Pujols if they were under a salary cap. I think there's some other teams. I think the Cardinals would be in that situation. Now, they've done it a little differently, but I'll go back to when you had Edmonds, Pujols, Roland, and Holiday all on the same team. You couldn't have kept those guys under a reasonable salary cap and expected to have pitching or something else along the way that you were going to need. So, you know, the owners who understand how the game works from an investment standpoint and making sure you have a legitimate farm system, making sure you zero in on certain positions on the field that you're not going to overspend on, and the little nuances that we've even seen the Cardinals do, there just aren't enough teams that have figured that out yet. So therefore, they throw all their money into one or two players, and then they look around. They don't know how to fix it anywhere else. So I agree with you. I think the teams that know how to win, they don't need a salary cap. They can get it figured out in a manner where either they commit to two or three guys long term and then they rent a guy or two along the way. That's probably the way to go compared to some other teams who mortgage their future every year. When they get a good player, they figure they can trade them and go get some more prospects and then hope lightning strikes a bottle, you know, for a year or two. I look at the Kansas City Royals as an example where, you know, they moved some players to get some other players, and then they had some young kids come up, and all of a sudden you got a good team. But they couldn't keep that team together because they knew eventually they were going to have to pay some of those younger kids, and they couldn't do it. Now, all of a sudden, they're at the end of the line again.
One element, too, that DeWitt talks about, and this probably speaks to them being a little bit more candid or being able to articulate it better, and it's probably something fans would benefit from hearing but maybe don't want to hear, but the rising cost of infrastructure, especially with teams, you know, diving headlong into analytics and larger data sets and more tech, whether it's, you know, Rapsodo and all this stuff. And, you know, when you talk about like, okay, well, you know, you're going to outfit every minor leaguer with a blast device. Well, that's not going to be the same as, you know, it's not going to be the same cost as saying going out and getting a middle reliever, right? But it's still part of the baseball operations cost. And, you know, one of the things that has happened over time is coaching staffs have grown, front offices have grown. We've seen such title inflation. The Cardinals have multiple assistant general managers now, where, you know, not too long ago, John Mozeliak was the assistant general manager, and that was it. Now he's a president, and they have a general manager. Where once there were two jobs, there are now five. And where once there were two salaries, there are now five. And where once there was, you know, guys who only had opportunity to move up, you know, with other teams if they moved up in title too, now there's chance to move up in salary and chance to have a new title invented for you and all this stuff. So you have seen an inflation in that regard. And first, and you and I have both seen this, an increase in salary of coaches. And that's not boiled into payroll, in part because, you know, teams don't advertise what they're paying their pitching coach, or managers don't have it structured well where they share each other's salary. But we have seen spending grow in that regard, which I think has curtailed spending on players, which I think is a reason to be frustrated for players. But it's also a reason to understand where the money is going and where they're investing.
There's two things that I think that we probably don't talk enough about. You mentioned the fact, the increase in staff. I know Bill DeWitt mentioned they went from like 250 to 400 employees in about a year period. Yeah. But here, there's two things here. One, we're talking about the operations side, What about the marketing side? Because, you know, there's so many more layers to that now, because they found out that they can make money with promotions and they can make money doing some other things digitally. You know, where now the Cardinals have a digital department that wasn't in play 5 years ago. But, you know, it's able to, for them to control their message better.
Replace me.
That's what they're trying to. It seems like that. And I think they're going in the wrong direction. And we'll come back to that. But the other thing is, they're going to try and save money by contracting the minor leagues. I mean, there are going to be some coaches and obviously some players that won't have jobs after this year. And they're trying to cut off one end in order to try and keep a balance. But it's something that I think we're going to see more of because, again, they're still looking for that next revenue stream that's going to really put them in another class compared to where they're at now. Because as I said, I think they kind of maxed out on the things that we thought was going to help them get over the hump. I'll go back to, well, we need a new stadium so we can have this, this, and this, and this and increase our revenue stream. We need luxury boxes. Okay, we did that. Then we come through the situation where we need to try and do some things better marketing wise. And then we get the local TV radio deal. Then here comes the MLB vehicle itself as far as the digital side. So they've exhausted all those revenue streams. So now it's time to do something else. Now you've got two things you can do. You can contract the minor leagues. And if you really need cash, and I think it may come after this CBA thing, we're going to expand again. Expansion is always an option. The challenge that they're going to run into with the contraction of the minor leagues, and we don't know how many teams it's going to be or how many leagues it's going to be. I think we have a pretty good idea. The talent pool may not be as rich, or maybe it may be better because we'll shave off the scrubs. And so now all of a sudden, a guy who's in your organization, he might be able to play and he might be readily available to play for an expansion team.
Yeah, that's if teams teeter and totter and some go into financial distress, which is expected. You know, it's more likely that you see teams move. This is going to have repercussions. Where they go that is will be based on where they can find, you know, probably subsidies for a new stadium. But you're right. The lottery ticket then to save teams is the cash infusion that comes from expansion fees. Yeah. And that would be one alternative for them. Who do you think, Mike, is winning the goodwill of the fans? I mean, you mentioned like Blake Snell on Twitch, that got a lot of attention where he was saying, you know, I'm not going to risk, you know, for reduced pay. You have other players being very public. Jack Flaherty has been rather public on social media, sometimes with GIF references, sometimes just with, you know, little asides, you know. And then you have comments like what the owners of the Cubs made or what DeWitt said about profits. They've all kind of gotten the fans' attention, gotten message boards and Twitter stirring. So who's doing a better job in the tug of war for the goodwill of the fans at this point, or are neither doing any?
I'm going to tell you, for our listeners and viewers, who are accustomed to the history of World War II, the battles that took place in Europe, they call them the hedgerows, where, you know, you would fight, you know, all day or two or three days in a row to get 35, 40 yards of real estate. And then 3 days later, you were back to where you started. Let's go to World War One. I mean, the trench wars, you know, you did a lot of battling only to get a small portion of real estate. It would cost you a lot of men. It would cost you equipment and material. But, you know, that's how you fought it. And I think we're seeing that with baseball, because both sides can make a point that you can kind of say, ah, and then there's another side. Then there's another element that both sides would be accused of being greedy, because how many times have you heard the term just billionaires arguing with millionaires? You know, something that 99% of the people who follow the game have nothing in common with when it comes to millions and billions of dollars. So there's enough dislike to go around. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. In the meantime, since there have been no games And since we last saw a Cardinals games, the country has been plunged into tandem crises. There's been, and both of them have health and cultural factors. You know, there's obviously the coronavirus, which led to the stoppage of play. And then there was, you know, the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the knee of a police officer that has reignited protests, you know, discussions of race relations, racial inequalities, and allowed, maybe because there aren't games, some athletes to find their voices, participate in protests as opposed to headed to the ballpark. We've seen a lot of that. Mike, you've been around many sports through your career, through your various careers, from your love of hockey to your relationship with basketball and now being around the Cardinals and baseball so long. What do you make of what we've seen? Why have we seen the volume of athletes' voices increase at this point?
I think there's a couple of things. I think, first of all, because the athletes have nothing to do. They're not playing. They're not worried about the heart of the order that they're facing tonight, or they're not worried about, they're not thinking about, you know, who are they going to guard in the playoffs, or, you know, you name the sport, they're not playing. So the focus is shifted. And I think the other issue is because we're actually seeing, and, you know, people who are of color already know the story, but people who are white and have heard about it and kind of was an eye roll and can't believe this could happen in 2020. Well, now that they see it on the evening news and everywhere else, they say to themselves, wow, I didn't know it was like this. So it's created a greater discussion. I really think if we were involved in sports, if we were sitting here talking about Flag Day and who was playing well and this and that, and the NBA Finals and the Stanley Cup Finals were around, Derek, I don't think we would have many players saying very much. That's unfortunate because they were just going about their business, or they would be like in the old days, well, that's not something I'm into. I think because of the time. And I also think because this generation of athlete relates to their parents or parent more with regard to the injustices that they suffered or their grandparents suffered. So they're quite familiar with what's going on, and they have a voice, and they don't mind sharing it because a lot of them are financially secure that they can say it. You know, there was a time when guys were like, man, I can't say too much because I don't want to lose my job, because you would be punished. But now guys are like, bring it on. That's why LeBron and guys who have had financial success, they have no problem dropping the gloves and saying what's on their mind and having the wherewithal to back it up. And I think those are some of the reasons. And I think the other thing is, man, I think guys are just tired. I think they're tired of what they see. They're tired of what they hear. They probably have experienced some sort of injustice in their own sport. And I think baseball probably would lead the way with regard to the lack of African Americans at any level. You name it, from the top on down. I mean, you know, how many black owners do you have? And spare me on Derek Jeter. Derek Jeter is just a managing partner, okay? Derek Jeter didn't put that much skin in the game to be an owner. But you look at the general managers, you don't have many of them. You don't even have black bat boys, okay? So it goes all the way from the top to the bottom. You don't even have black equipment managers. You may have an assistant somewhere. So the fact that these guys have seen enough of it in their own sport, they just probably had enough of it and just feel like now's the time to say something. I commend them on speaking out, because it's amazing when an athlete says, how it gives a subject more credibility than anything else. And I'll give you a good example. We danced around the Colin Kaepernick issue for the last few years, and many were led to believe Colin Kaepernick was everything from the second coming of Joseph Stalin to, you know, somebody who could be a bin Laden's cousin, because he was a bad guy, because he didn't stand up for the flag, because he hated policemen. That was never, ever the issue. And he mentioned, I'm just trying to bring attention to the injustices that black people are dealing with at the hands of the police. So he loses his career and everybody thinks he's a bad guy. The president has said, well, he didn't stand up for the flag, get rid of him. It took Drew Brees to make a statement that he had to apologize for, to come back on Twitter and tell the president, hey, man, it was never about the flag. It was never about it. But once Drew Brees said it, then everybody else now says, well, maybe Roger Goodell comes out and says, we were wrong. People are saying maybe they should apologize to Colin Kaepernick. Derek, that conversation would have never taken place had Drew Brees not said what he said, because he put the president in check. He's used this as part of his propaganda machine as far as misleading the country about something that most people of color already knew was wrong in the first place. But it took Drew Brees to step up and remind the president that he was wrong about this whole situation.
I mean, it also speaks to the power of words, right?
Absolutely.
Like, if we could redo the description of it, and we can't, but maybe we could do a better job of describing it from here forward. Instead of saying that Colin Kaepernick took a knee in protest, why not say he took a knee in mourning? Wouldn't that give it a different look? Like, if we accurately portrayed what he was doing, especially, you know, when the stories came about how he got the idea, who he got the idea from, and it was about taking a knee for a fallen soldier, for taking a knee for a fallen comrade, for a fallen friend. If we say Colin Kaepernick took a knee during the national anthem in mourning, doesn't that sound different than a knee in protest? And isn't it truer?
You are spot on, because the word protest lends a negative connotation to people that protest makes people uncomfortable with. You know, if you say protest to a person who feels like they're part of the problem, then they're going to push back and say, oh, no. But mourning, everybody raises an eyebrow and tries to empathize with what's going on. And that's a very good point that I don't think has been talked about enough. The difference in one word and how it would be perceived from that point on.
Baseball had one player take a knee during the national anthem at that time, not others. In your experience with sports, has baseball lagged behind in making social statements than the other sports? And if you think so, why?
Yeah, they have. And the player you're talking about, the backup catcher in Oakland, once they pushed him out of the game, he went to Mexico and played there and lit it up and didn't even get an invite to a spring training. Jeez. I think the reason being, while baseball was a forerunner to give Jackie Robinson a chance to play, there was always the good old boy network of saying, let's not let them get too carried away. You know, let's put them in their place when we need to. And whether they stereotype you as a troublemaker and all of a sudden you move from one team to another, or all of a sudden you don't get the invite to spring training, I think that baseball has always felt like they could drop the hammer on a guy's career and would move on to the next good player. I don't think if Mookie Betts were to come out and be considered a disruptive force, they'd say, well, that's all right. We'll wait him out and we'll find some other good young player. I mean, there have been a lot of black players who I think's careers have either been shortened or altered because of maybe their ability to talk back and challenge authority, not in a disrespectful manner, but just say why. And, you know, you get the wrong manager or the wrong general manager and they think old boy, good old boy, old school mentality, you're out. You're out of the game. And, you know, there's a lot of guys who probably saw their careers get cut short because of that, along with the stereotype where we had this conversation the other day. Seldom do you see a black utility player. You know, any guy who's playing in the big leagues probably has a start, unless you are like the pinch hitter extraordinaire, or maybe you like have been able to amass some quality innings as a setup guy. There's no room in the dugout for a black bench player, or at least there hasn't been as much room as we've seen some other teams carry guys we had no business playing. And then when they do offer you a contract, it's one that's not even respectable with regard to your peers. And that's their way of phasing guys out of the game. Hmm. And it's been something that's gone on for a long time. Every sport has it. The NFL is good at it, too. But I think in baseball, the subject of the sport we're talking about, they have been a little slow in trying to do something about it. And I also think it has a lot to do with how front offices are made up, managers, that whole situation where, you know, they had to dust Baker off to have him come in and hopefully save the Houston Astros. And I found that interesting. Of all the managers who they could have gone out to find credibility, to give that Houston Astros situation credibility, they had to find Dusty Baker. This is a guy who couldn't get a job, and he wanted to get back in the game. Couldn't get a job on merit, but because they needed Dusty Baker to bring a big fire hose and an axe to try and put out a fire, that's the only reason why he got a job. And there's something wrong with that, along with the fact that general managers in this game that are of color don't get the length or the shelf life that we've seen some other guys who continue to get out of line and find work again. It just doesn't work that way. And granted, some of these guys were saddled with bad owners, bad organizations, poor scouting, and they just didn't have a lot of talent to work with. But, you know, and maybe they didn't deserve to stay any longer. But, man, I'll tell you, when you see a person of color that's in a management role, his shelf life is much shorter than a lot of his peers.
Can this conversation change that equation, though, Mike? Can players being more forthright, especially now, can that alter how things operate months from now, a year from now? Can baseball's practices change with baseball players finding their voice now?
I would like to say yes, but I'm not sure if that's possible. And I think the best example is we still continue to lack minorities playing the game. I mean, the number continues to dwindle. And it's not all baseball's fault. I mean, there's obviously more options, but I just don't see enough people of color in positions of decision making. I don't see enough that are legitimate managers or getting that opportunity to manage. How many black bench coaches do we have in baseball now? And it seems like we've gone from being a bench coach that gives you a chance to be a manager to being an analytic guy. So my question would be, how many guys do we see that actually have a voice or seat at the analytic table? Mm. So, you know, they continue to move the change the qualifications, which is unfortunate, but I think we have to really want to do it. I mean, everybody's, you know, I've heard more lip service and apologies in 1 week than I've heard in my entire life from everyone who feels like they want to do something the right way. I think we're at a point now where action is more important, and who is willing to step up and say, hey, look, we're not doing this to beat on our chest and say, hey, look at us. We're doing it because it's the right thing to do. And how we go about that, I think, is something we're all waiting to see, because I don't know if there's a perfect step to do it. I think everybody's got to kind of look in their own backyard and figure out the best course for them with the resources that they have. And I also think that they have to be, and I've said this from day one, they got to be better listeners. Mm. They've got to be able to listen instead of the old eye roll or, yeah, here we go again, but or what about this? You know, they're always the distractive question and not really addressing the issue. We got to get out of that mode and be better listeners on why we're here and why this is important. So there's got to be a lot of hand-wringing that's going to take place. I think the players still have to be vigilant even when they're playing again. And again, I'll go back to my original point. I think the reason why this has been such a subject is because nobody was playing. If they were playing, it'd be a whole different animal. So when we do resume playing, they still have to remain vigilant in making sure that the people who said that, you know, we want to do something better or do it differently, that they put their money or they put their word where their mouth is.
One of the things that baseball could do is exactly what you just mentioned when it comes to like front offices and analytics, is put money there. When it comes to internships, don't count on kids who are coming out of school and want to work so bad for a baseball team that they'll work for free, because that limits the pool you can choose from, because that's the group that can be subsidized by their parents or be in their hometown. You want to make substantial changes. You want to increase the diversity of applicants and talent pool for the, you know, for analytics and for front offices. Invest in the internships. Start paying.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think the Cardinals have what they call a fellowship program. And Javier Duran, a local young man, has gone through the program, and now he's part of the operations side.
That's awesome.
And it's a good move. I mean, they have him and Jared Odom. Kerry Robinson are the people of color on the operations side. Now, that's three guys. And the operations side has grown immensely. But that doesn't mean that three is enough. I think you still want to make sure you have quality individuals and people who can grow within the organization. You know, I always tell young people that once you get in the system of a pro sports team, whether you're selling tickets or you're in marketing or whatever, you can find your path to what you really want to do, but you have to get in the system and you have to continue to work at it and ask questions and don't be afraid to step up and say, I'd like to try it, and always check the postings to see what's out there. But getting in the system has been a challenge for people of color.
The system has to be more open, though. Like, I agree completely. You have to get through the door to find out where, you know, where your path goes or what cubicle you fit in. But you have to be able to get that door open. And it seems like, you know, baseball is at this real fragile time when we talk about finances, you know, to circle back on it, is this notion of, you know, they need to invest in finding, you know, in a more diverse talent pool when it comes to front offices, when it comes to coaches, when it comes to managers. They need to invest in really growing the game in communities where the game is non-existent or where it's been overtaken by other sports because baseball is prohibitive, whether it's travel baseball and the cost that is prohibitive or just unappealing, or the game itself is, you know, has a slow pace or for whatever reason. You know, I remember covering a high school game in New Orleans, in the city of New Orleans, and it you know, kids left their gloves at their position for the next kid to play. So top of the inning, bottom of the inning, they didn't have their own gloves and they shared it between teams. So the shortstops on rival teams were using the same gloves. And that wasn't all that long ago. So baseball has an opportunity to invest in its future, both on and off the field. And yet at the same time, we're talking about how owners are saying the profits aren't there to invest in the current structure. And, oh, by the way, they want to shutter part of the minor leagues, which will then cut even further into the future. I mean, it just seems like a real fragile time for the game.
It is, Derek. And I think the other thing that goes into play here is this is the ultimate good old boy network of guys getting hired because they were roommates or they went to college together or their families were members of the country club, you know, and people of color have yet to be able to crack that inner circle. Now, there have been a few people that have been able to do it, but not as many as they need to. I know baseball has tried to do something on a league level that I don't think they've done well as far as being able to promote or make talent available. Personally speaking, I'd love to be part of something like that to go out because I think I have a pretty good idea of what it takes. And I'd love to be part of something to create more opportunities. And I don't want to just limit this to Black people. I think that there's a lot of people. And I think the Latin community has certainly been given more opportunities here recently. And it's well deserved. I mean, you look at a guy like Moises Rodriguez and what he means to the Cardinals.
Yeah.
And you know, Randy Flores, you know, a USC guy, well-educated former player. You know, those guys deserve a crack at this, too. So I don't want to just limit it to just people who grew up in North St. Louis or grew up in the inner city. I think people, you know, the game used to be very diverse as far as the players on the field. And I like to see that kind of trickle upstairs a little bit more because there's just too many guys that are familiar with each other.
Yeah, both Flores and Rodriguez are considered future, you know, GMs or president of baseball operations. Yeah.
They're going to have their own team within 3 years.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things, and deserve it, by the way. I think what we've seen them do and how they conduct themselves and the professional approach and the impact that they're having on the organization, and I'm going to say this, I think it's a tribute to John Mozeliak. Mo's got probably more front office candidates at his disposal than maybe anywhere in baseball. you look at Mike Gersh, you look at Randy Flores, you look at Moises Rodriguez, and there's some other guys coming up in that pipeline. And I tip my cap to him for at least being conscious and having a tree that he's going to be very proud of as far as guys that are going to have an impact on the game. Could he do more? Sure. They all could do more, but I think the fact that you got to be willing to take a chance and get outside your bubble, and he's done that on an initial level, and hopefully he'll continue to do it.
So with all that is going on besides games at this point, the country starting to reopen after so much of it was shut down to deal with the coronavirus to quote-unquote flatten the curve, concerns of a second wave, then we have the protests in every city. If baseball does not return, or if it returns in some milquetoast bland way after all this squabbling while bigger issues are going on, does baseball surrender its place in our culture, Mike, if it chooses not to lead?
Yeah, it does. Baseball is about to enter the perfect storm of disaster and getting out of line. Obviously, the pandemic has changed how it's going to be viewed and covered. That's a challenge that they've yet to work through. Throw in the fact that there are other sports leagues that are now going to take their place in the prime time of their season, June, July, August, September. You know, remember that at one point they had it all to themselves until the NFL came along and college football came along in September. So that and the fact that the image that they're going to bestow on their fans of being greedy, selfish, is something the fans are going to, and throw this in too. With the pandemic and us being isolated and having to find alternatives, there are people that will say, you know what, I realize I didn't need baseball as much as I thought I did because I'm doing this, this, and that now. I may be a casual fan, but I won't be an avid fan anymore. And this is where baseball, if they elect to pull the pin on the grenade here, they better make sure that their marketing plan on getting people back is one that's going to be believable. I mean, you can't gimmick up the game, okay? And I think we've heard various ideas on how to speed up the game and make it more attractive. And I agree that it should take place in some way, shape, or form, but you can't gimmick it up too much to the point where people don't recognize it anymore. And that would create an even bigger stir as the other sports leagues try and forge ahead. You just create a greater distance as you'll be back in the pack and you may not be able to get back up.
What was the slogan that they had? Let the kids play.
Let the kids play.
So maybe they come back and, you know, the slogan is let the kids talk.
That's not a bad idea. Now, here's the challenge that you run with that. You know, because baseball it trends to a little bit older audience.
Yeah.
You have to make a decision. Do we stay with that older audience or do we try and bring in new people? Because the older audience is going to say things like, I didn't turn the game on to hear this guy tell me his thoughts about something I don't care about, or stick to sports, or stick to things of that nature, compared to a younger audience that they can relate to and say, hey, good for you, man. I know where you're coming from. And those younger audiences will have more of an interest in following that person socially. And obviously you can do it via social media, because they'll find that they may have more in common with them other than the game that they're watching. And that's something that we're learning about social media and players who are able to open themselves up and let people know, I like playing Xbox and I like doing this and I'm doing this as a hobby. And then all of a sudden the guy said, hey, you know, I'm doing that too. And you know, and I'll give you a good example. You know, you see athletes who talk about being musicians and they play the guitar on the road or whatever. Adam Wainwright's a good example. Mike Matheny was as well. And then you have fans like, yeah, you know, I play. And that gives them one more connection of the dots that they can appreciate. And, you know, maybe they share the same political views. Maybe they share the same social views. Maybe not. But it's something that they feel like they've got in common with them compared to the older set that's set in their ways and doesn't really care about what you do off the field, doesn't really care what your social feelings are and how things work in your community. They just want you to go out and pitch, catch, and throw.
I hope this not only increases the decibel level of some of those things that people are doing and saying, but also allows for an increase in the acceptance of it too. That's clearly part of it is.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, Derek. Acceptance, that's a good word to use here. And I look at this in this regard. I may not necessarily be on board line for line, but I accept your observation and your opinion. And accept leads to respect. And if you have respect, that means we can coexist and feel like, okay, well, I know he feels this way. I'm a little different, but I understand where he's coming from because he walked a different path than I did. You know, if you get that conversation going and you get that level where everybody kind of nods their head and says, okay, I get it. That really solves the next generation of issues or certainly puts you on the path for it. You know, right now we don't have enough people that are willing to accept. They figured it's only been their way, and anything else you bring to me is subversive or even worse, and I don't want that to be part of what I'm about.
Do you think baseball will have players kneel during the anthem, Mike?
Well, I hope they do. You know, because what's going on in our country right now is not going to go away when the pandemic does. This is something that's going to be ongoing for years to come, maybe not as many years. But I think the reason, and I brought this up to somebody the other day, the NBA is 84% African-American. And when the protests first took place, not one player in the NBA took a knee. Reason being, Adam Silver and the league and the Players Association got out in front and set up vehicles for players to express their feelings about concerns in their community. They had more community action activities for them to participate in where they could go out and speak their piece, and they utilized social media in a productive manner. The owners didn't fight it. The league didn't fight it. And I don't know whether they had a handshake agreement that they weren't going to take a knee. But if all sports that you would have thought would have taken a knee because of the people who play it, you would have thought it would have been the NBA. They didn't, because I commend their leadership in being out in front and finding another way to continue to get their point across and not disrespect anybody else as far as not taking a knee. You got to remember, the old guard of baseball is different, yeah, man. I mean, you can be punished quickly. I would like to see it. I don't think it'll happen.
Be great if they open up those avenues. Like you said, you don't have to agree with the stance, but respect the stance and ask why. And then maybe that opens other avenues to make the same point. And baseball, by listening, by doing what you said, that's really, it's really thoughtful on the NBA's part. And, you know, to have buy-in from the players too, to realize the strength of that, that's possible for baseball to do. I mean, that
it is.
I think it would be possible for baseball to do that.
But, you know, and here's the other thing about the NBA. The NBA has, they I know baseball has a great union or a powerful union. So the NBA is right there. But you know what it also creates, Derek? It creates conversation amongst players. You know, you look at the melting pot of baseball and the few people of color that are on each team. I wonder how often a guy who didn't look like Dexter Fowler or Tommy Pham went over and asked them about what kind of things that they have to deal with. I wonder how many times those guys actually cared or even believed in what they were telling them. So you have to have the internal conversation so they can all be on the same page, because a lot of guys, a lot of white guys can tell you, man, I never thought that kind of stuff existed, or I didn't know. And, you know, they just don't know in some cases, or didn't pay attention enough, or in the end result, maybe just didn't care.
Wow.
Because all they wanted to do was play baseball. I just think when you're with guys for 8 months out of the year, it's more than trying to hit a cutter. It's more than trying to figure out, you know, why your fastball isn't moving the way it should be. You know, this is it's a true family, and sports has always lended the opportunity for diversity with regard to teams that win. I always ask people, when you're winning the Stanley Cup or the World Series, do you look and say, hey, there's my black teammate over there who's winning with me? No, he's your teammate. You know, when there's a brawl that breaks out, you know, do you say, all right, I'm going to go look for the white guy, or I'm going to go hit the black guy first? They don't do that kind of stuff. I mean, they're you know, it's a team function that we have to take into account. And I would only hope that their ability to have such a forum can lead into other things that can make this whole situation more effective and where we can get more out of this.
Well, Mike, we began this conversation by talking about Flag Day having a ceremonial importance when it comes to the standing. Flag Day goes back almost 250 years in our country as a way to commemorate the official adoption of the flag of the United States, which obviously has changed. It's always on June 14th. And as this one arrives and there are no games scheduled for Flag Day, the conversation has bent towards, you know, the protests, racial inequality, racial injustice. What I wonder is if this essential conversation that we're having that has allowed us to revisit why a quarterback took a knee brings us here right around Flag Day and offers a sport the opportunity to take a stand.
You know, I hope they do. And I hope that everybody, when they look at the flag, they'll have a greater appreciation for what it should symbolize, the United States of America. You know, because this is our thing. This isn't just the black thing or the white thing. This is everybody, man. And we're all under that flag. And, you know, I have great respect for what it's meant to so many people and the people who have made the sacrifice to where it flies with so much dignity and respect and meaning to this country. But I think we've got to make sure that it has the same meaning and impact and respect for everybody in this country. We need to come together and be on the same page and basically just be a good teammate. I think anybody who understands sports and understands what a good teammate is all about, we need that to be more of a social teammate in our society today. And if we can do that, I think we'll all feel better about our lives, our direction, and our purpose on the planet.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you for taking this time. It's good to chat with you. I wish it were at a ballpark. I wish it were together before a game or perhaps maybe at PNC Park, for example, or somewhere. I wish it were, but it's good to chat with you. Hope you're healthy, and I really appreciate just the thoughts you've given here.
Well, I appreciate you. I consider you a great friend in this business, and we've known each other for so long, and listening to you and watching your family grow, I always get a kick out of. I'm just pissed off that you didn't ask me before. It took a pandemic for you to call me, man. You know, you're one of my favorites, man. You're one of my favorite people. I admire your effort and your diligence to do a job that has become more challenging than ever before. With social media in tune, you are on call 25 hours a day, and you always find a way to inform people objectively with correct information. And I feel like after reading your work, I'm a lot smarter, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate that in this day of misinformation. You are the beacon to what it's all about here in St. Louis.
Thank you very much, Mike. I honestly, I was waiting for Flag Day. That was my, I mean, it's a day that I associate with Mike Claiborne. You know, it's always better when we have standings to talk about on Flag Day. But this just seemed like a good chance to hit on more important topics.
Well, you know what, Derek? What we'll do, once we figure out what the schedule is, we'll have staff day from which the flag flies from.
Yes.
Because we don't want to put a flag up, but we will have to circle a day that we have to start paying attention closer. It'll be a shorter window, obviously, and we'll have to rely on what we've seen and what we expect. But we'll call it staff day because we don't want to hang a flag on.
Let's do that. We'll do that. Okay. So that'll be appointment podcasting. We will do that.
I'm looking forward to it, man. Let's do it. good health to your family as well. And I've said this to a few people, and I'm going to say it to you. When we are able to be under the same roof, I will break social distancing rules because I'm going to hug everybody.
That sounds good, Mike. Special thanks, of course, to Mike Claiborne of Claibs Online and one of the Cardinals broadcasters at KMOX 1120 AM for joining me for that conversation and for coming on the podcast to mark the arrival of Flag Day. You can find previous episodes of the best podcast in baseball brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis at stltoday.com, along with all of our constant Cardinals coverage, which will include ongoing draft coverage throughout this week. That's right, there will be actual baseball activities, transactions to discuss. The Cardinals have 7 picks. That's tied with the Giants for the most. They have 1 pick, the 21st overall, on the first day of the draft, and then 6 picks, many of them clustered right there in a group on the second day of the draft. For the first time since 2012, they have 5 picks in the top 100. This is a chance to stockpile talent, but it comes when the draft has never been this abbreviated. 5 rounds, that's it. And then a wild, wild frontier of free agents with a bonus cap of $20,000. We've never seen a draft like this, which makes it all the more important for the Cardinals to get some talent out of this draft. The Best Podcast in Baseball is also available wherever you get your podcasts. That includes Stitchers and a whole cornucopia of places to plug in for podcasts. It also includes iTunes, where you can listen to individual episodes, you can download individual episodes, you can subscribe to the podcast subscriptions, make the sponsorships possible, sponsorships make the weekly podcast possible. Also, please rate and review. There's been some quality reviews there, some pointed ones, some critical ones. It's been good there at iTunes. So please do rate and review the Best Podcast in Baseball. The Best Podcast in Baseball is brought to you by Closet by Design of St. Louis. Get organized with Closet by Design of St. Louis. Update your closet, garage, office, pantry, and more. Call 1-800-BY-DESIGN. That's 1-800-BYDESIGN. Closets by Design, the official sponsor of the Best Podcast in Baseball. The owners and players are racing towards the precipice of having to come to an agreement or having to move on from the 2020 season and into a far murkier picture of what 2021 looks like. They'd rather have games than just months and months of acrimony. For BPIB, I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould. Look forward to talking to you soon. Stay healthy out there.